I think at this point all know who I am. This is our Newsmaker Breakfast Series with Senator Dodd, who we're thrilled to have here today. I really do prefer doing these in the small room up here as opposed to the cavernous room downstairs. So I think when we can, we'll do them up here. I think it just facilitates a better dialogue. I don't know if you're counting, but I was counting. This is the fourth in our series sponsored by families and NFIB and the Kaiser Family Foundation. As you know, it's the job of the hosts to keep our mouths shut and not say too much these breakfasts, because they are for the newsmakers, for the senator, and most especially they are for you. So my role is to welcome you. It is also to remind you that our next newsmaker will be Senator Hatch, and that is on May 7th, so stay tuned for that. Plus, as you know, I always try and have one fact for you at each breakfast. Last time it was 19.7, which was the average number of years between these major health reform debates, which is why we need to make the most of this window of opportunity, or we could be waiting a while. And this time I picked one out of the blue. It's 59%, and that was the percentage of the public who reported in our new tracking poll that they're putting off care, or they're skipping care, or they're skipping treatment altogether because of high health care costs. And it's just a very big number, and it reminds us that the problems which are behind this debate and which have put this debate back on the agenda are still very much there and in big numbers. So that's my number for the week, 59%. I know some weeks it's hard to come up with a number of the week. Let me invite Susan Eckerly to say a few words, who's here from the NFIB, and then Ron will, as we always do, introduce the senator, and we'll be off and running.
Hello, everyone. Good morning, and thanks for coming. I'm Susan Eckerly. I'm the Senior Vice President for Public Policy at NFIB, and we want to thank Senator Dodd and all of you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come here and discuss this important topic. The senator, I know, recently held roundtables on health care in Connecticut. I know some of our members participated and appreciated the emphasis you put on paying attention to the cost of health care. And I think, as you know, and as everyone's heard us say many times, the cost and availability of health care has been the number one priority for our members and problem for our members since 1984. And we're very excited about the next few months and upcoming debate, and just want to emphasize again how important paying attention to cost is during that debate, and not placing any new mandates on small business at a time when they're trying to keep their head above water. But with that, thank you for coming, and turn it over to Ron.
Hi, I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our honored guest. This is an auspicious week for healthcare reform. The budget resolution is being passed that allows for bipartisanship, but allows for the alternative if that does not actually materialize. And it is even more auspicious because we have Senator Dodd joining us here today for this Newsmaker Breakfast. Senator Dodd is not just the longest-serving senator in Connecticut history, but he's taking on some of the biggest challenges that we as a nation have. All of you know, of course, that he chairs the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. But we've asked him to join us today because of the role he plays on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, where he chairs the Subcommittee on Children and Families. As you probably know, Senator Dodd is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Help Committee after his good friend, the chair, Senator Ted Kennedy. The Help Committee is one of the two committees that has jurisdiction over health care reform. And the senator's staff has participated quite valiantly and regularly in the so-called workhorse meetings that the committee has been hosting twice a week, meetings to get prepared for health care reform. So there's no doubt Senator Dodd is going to be playing a leadership role when Congress passes health care reform. So with that, it's a thrill to welcome you here, and we welcome your comments.
Well, thanks very much, Ron, and I thank all of you for coming out this morning. Let me thank the Kaiser Family Foundation, NFIB, and all of you for spending a few minutes this morning. And as Ron has said, I suppose in somewhat of a different capacity here, obviously, and with my chairman of the committee, Senator Kennedy, who's doing very well, and as many of you may know, and has been more actively involved in the last couple of months. Back, we had a very good long meeting last week with a sort of group of 11, a smaller group, with Senator Grassley, Senator Hatch, Senator Enzi, myself, Senator Kennedy, talking about where we were at this juncture. We went about 11 different meetings. We had five different meetings, excuse me, at that level over the last number of weeks. So in a sense, I'm here as a sort of a deputy, in a sense. Senator Harkin, Senator Mikulski, and Senator Bingaman have been carrying the heavy load in the committee dealing with the 11 hearings they've had on prevention, coverage, and quality. In fact, Senator Bingaman has a hearing today where the states have been involved in the issue are going to be testifying before the committee as well about their experiences, ones that have been actively engaged in the issue of health care. So in a sense, if he were feeling a little bit better, Senator Kennedy would be sitting in this chair. So I want to be clear about here in a sense and picking up on this. Let me commend Families USA, too, as well. You've done some great things. The recent announcement with Pharma, Ron, I think was terrific on dealing with Medicaid, raising those levels to 133%, I think, at the federal levels of poverty, and expanding for moderate-income families who are caught between making too much to qualify for Medicaid and not enough to pay their premiums was a tremendous breakthrough as well. And the caps on some of the out-of-pocket expenses for medical expenses are great suggestions and deserve a lot of credit for mentioning them. Let me just can very briefly, because I think the questions you want to get to, break this down to the why, the how, and I want to spend just a couple minutes on children. And having spent the last 26 years on the committee and over the last 20 more years as chairing, being the ranking Democrat on the subcommittee on children and families, where the Family Medical Leave Act, the child care program I did with Orrin Hatch, premature births, infant screening, autism, a lot of the stuff came out of that subcommittee. So I have a particular interest as this issue goes forward to focus on children. And so I wanted to mention a few comments on that. First of all, the why. And again, I'm probably, you all spend so much time on this, you've heard a lot of this. It's fairly obvious whether you're looking at foreclosures. Ron mentioned the banking committee. 50% of all foreclosures in the country that are occurring in part because of a medical problem that people are having. You look at the issues of the economy. And again, you're getting 16% of gross domestic product as health care costs. Some have anticipated that number jumps to about 20% by the year 2018, and others have even suggested you could double that figure over the next 10 years of the percentage of the gross domestic product that healthcare costs would consume. So in addition to the moral, ethical issues, if you will, the compelling question of having 45 million of your fellow citizens uncovered, 9 million of that 45 million are children in the country. The fact that even those who are paying premiums are strapped financially to the point where they can hardly afford it. In fact, I think it was Ron, U.S. Families, that pointed out that between 2007 and 2008, one out of every three Americans went through one gap period when they had no coverage in that period. So in addition to this notion that everyone has it all the time, is just not the case. The issue of obviously with unemployment, people 20,000 people a day losing their jobs, 10,000 homes going into foreclosure a day, that obviously puts additional strain and pressures on families. So the personal cost of obviously losing coverage, there are even implications in terms of international competitiveness. I mean, the rationale for this is becoming so compelling that there is a sense of urgency about this that raises my level of optimism. Having been a relatively junior member 15 years ago, but actively involved in the debate on the Health Committee, when the Clinton administration made the effort, I can just tell you that the difference in these meetings has been significant. The healthcare summit at the White House, I sat next to the guy who wrote the Harry and Louise ads back in 1993 and 94. He's now planning on, I don't know whether he's going to write the ads or produce them, but he's at the table wanting to be a part of the solution this time of universal healthcare. There are four pillars that we're working on, the quality issue, the prevention issue, obviously, the cost, And the universality, the four, and that order I've mentioned them is not necessarily the order they preference. You could rearrange those four in any way you'd like. And there is a sense that those four elements are going to have to be a part of a plan that emerges. So the reasons people being at the table, there are different reasons, obviously, but the major change is the economic questions that have really drawn a lot of people to the table that were, in fact, opposed to doing anything 15 years ago. But today, it's essential that we go up with a plan that can work. Now, as to and there are additional reasons as to the why, but to the how, and this is where I see a significant difference. There have been the structure. Senator Baucus has done a terrific job on the Finance Committee, bringing together the 11 members I've mentioned to meet periodically here to talk about the various aspects of this. They've been quiet meetings, but nonetheless, I think very successful. The staffs have been working hard. Senator Kennedy's staff on our committee, along with Senator Enzi's staff and others who've been interested in the subject matter, the three senators I've mentioned, who have had very good hearings on it. Senator Kennedy and Senator Baucus, while there's not been that I'm aware of a single announcement on this, I think the idea is to have a single bill that will begin a markup either in late May or early June, with the goal by the end of July, before the August break, of actually producing a product here out of the Senate, is, I think, very, very encouraging. Even in the meetings where there has been the debates and discussion about reconciliation, or the debates and discussion about whether or not there'll be a public plan or not, my sense is that while there are clear differences in those two areas and others that will emerge, there's still an overriding sense of coming up with an answer to this, that it's not going to be excusable to turn around and say, because we weren't able to agree on some process question or a debate about how to emerge with whether or not you have a public plan or not, that we're going to lose this moment that many feel may not come again for a long time if we don't get this right. And so I guess the major point I'd like to make to you this morning, as someone who's as observing and participating in these discussions, is there is a clear determination to get to the goal line, to produce this product that will hopefully move us in the direction that all of us are interested in achieving, and that is a universal quality plan that is rooted in prevention and is affordable, and all of those issues. On children's points, the only reason I want to raise this is because the issues of coverage and prevention and quality with children don't necessarily match up neatly and tidily with adults. There are differences, and when looking at health care, children too often, I think, are, because they're, the good news is there's a relatively small population that need help, which is the great news, but nonetheless, they're not just smaller versions of adults. In terms of how the healthcare system relates to them and treats them is very, very important. And there are been discussions about how you might treat Medicaid. And while 21 million children are covered between the CHIP program and Medicaid, if there's any moderation in those ideas, and there's some that are floating around, then whether or not there's an alternative plan out there as part of exchanges that would actually take into the consideration of children and what happens to them. Just the issue of premature births costs us $26 billion a year. One out of eight children are born in that category. Just the economics of it, again, are pretty compelling. And so as one member of the committee, we're going to pay particularly attention to that subject matter as this moves forward to make sure that children will be given the kind of special consideration they deserve. And I think we were able to make that point when we did the Better Pharmaceuticals for Drugs, or the rule Senator Clinton at the time was deeply interested in proving that you do need to have a separate set of a criteria when you deal with children. So I just mentioned that as a personal note that I intend to keep an eye on during this process and debate. With that, let me sort of stop there. This is you've got a lot more probably specific questions about some of this stuff, and that would sort of give you a flavor. But the important point is I'm still tremendously optimistic we can get this done, and that sense of members working together, despite the obvious differences we've talked about, I think are going to get us to that goal line.
Thank you.
Thanks. No, whatever you want.
Okay. Yeah. For the record, if you, we know who you are, but if you say, it would be helpful. Thank you. Karen, you want?
Senator Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine. As I was driving here this morning, your voice was coming out of my radio, expressing some frustration, however, with the Republicans and the sort of a sense that they are not really yet into negotiating mode. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, is this a real give and take going on, or is this everybody just still sitting around the table and telling each other how much they want to get to the goal line?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And obviously the issue of reconciliation is the one that is has been on the table. But my sense of this is, look, I read Harry Reid's letter to Mitch McConnell, in which he once again expressed the desire to have this be a bipartisan bill that reaches across those lines. And I, having been involved in a lot of debates over the years, you don't get major things done without that. I never would have gotten the family and medical leave bill had it not been for Arlen Specter and Kit Bond, and Dan Coats, in fact, was involved back in those days. Never would have gotten the child care development block grants done without Orrin Hatch. I could just get on case after case. Rick Santorum and I did autism together. I mean, just in every instance I can think of, where it was something fairly major, you have to have that kind of cooperation. And this is obviously a case where that's got to be, that's got to happen. So I believe the leadership really is determined to achieve that. Max Baucus has talked about an American plan, and I think that's a good way to describe it. It's not trying to fashion some carbon copy or a weak copy of what someone else is doing around the world. And my sense, Karen, is that those motivations are very sincere. Now, having said all of that, the issue obviously comes back, well, why reconciliation? This issue is so big and so important that at the end of the of this, I hate the expression, the end of the day, but at the conclusion of all of this, if it comes down to the point where a minority within a minority are able to sort of sidetrack all of this or get something done in health care, I think many feel this is too big an issue to have fall prey to that. And so while I don't sense any appetite whatsoever to invoke reconciliation, none, I also sense there's even less of an appetite to lose the health care debate at the end because a handful of people decided they were going to oppose this and make it impossible to get to the conclusion of all of this. And that is sincerely felt. So I think we'll go through this, and I'm not going to bother going back over and revisiting history on the various times reconciliation has been used by others. I'm sure that'll happen during the debates in the coming weeks. But is it the Republicans will truly appreciate the sincerity that this desire to achieve that 70-75, the numbers that get bandied about, a result in the Senate to produce that bipartisan bill. That's not only important in terms of passing something, I think it's going to be critically important to developing the kind of support that we'll have to sustain with the American public if we're going to deal with the issue. There's going to be some additional cost associated with this plan if we're going to bend that curve that people talk about to reducing costs. So you're going to have to sustain public support for an effort. So something that passes by the narrowest of margins might have a difficult time being sustained over the coming years as we call for the additional investments to make this bill really work. Yeah.
Stephen Langill with Congress now. I was just wondering, given that reconciliation is just a fallback option, however, how have Republicans responded to this? Is this seen as bad faith on this part, on your part? Has this hurt the efforts to have negotiations?
That's being said at this point, and I've certainly heard it and listened to it in these meetings without attributing to any one individual or particular, but a generally held view, and you've heard, I think, probably people here that have spoken to you that express their concerns about it. But, you know, you start going back, and again, can you imagine in August or September, where this thing fails, and the reason it failed is because there was a battle over reconciliation. You go ahead and explain that to 10 Americans and tell me without one of them understand it on this thing. You know, I'm sorry, we couldn't deal with the problem of the uninsured, we couldn't deal with cost or quality, because there was this problem of reconciliation. That issue loses, falls like a stone when you get to the district line. And so I, for the life of me, that may be a heated debate over the coming days, I would not want to go back to my constituency and stand before, as we had in, I've had three healthcare forums. One of them I held at 8:30 on a Monday morning, and don't ask me why that ever happened. I mean, I thought, well, that's great. We're going to get about five people showing up at this thing at the Goodwin Community College in Hartford. And arrived at 8:30, there were 700 people at this healthcare forum. We did one at Danbury at Western Connecticut State University on a Saturday. That was like at 2 o'clock. There were 500 people. The Coast Guard Academy in New London, 11:30 on a Saturday morning, 500 people showing up. It went on for 2.5 hours on health care. Rosa DeLauro and I are doing one, I think, is it, I don't know, this weekend or next weekend? A couple weeks. And just the issue of coverage, of quality, of cost, all of these matters showing up. People are deeply, deeply interested in this subject matter, not just intellectually. People are showing up with anecdotes, what's happened to them along the way. And I just, with all due respect to my colleagues, I think it's an important point they're raising. It's a legitimate issue. But they need to listen to what we are saying. And as one who's been involved in a lot of debates on over the years, I truly want to see a bipartisan bill. And I believe the leader does. I know Senator Kennedy does. I know Senator Baucus feels this way. And so if we can get through this and get to the work of sitting down and trying to resolve these issues that are out there, I think that issue begins to dissipate. And to the extent we're unable, and the idea, I think, is to deal with the low-hanging fruit first, where we can agree on some things so you build a kind of confidence that members need to field in dealing with each other. And then we'll get to the tough questions. You get to the issue of define what a public plan means. How are you going to pay for this? Where are the cost issues? Those are tough questions. But my sense is that the Democratic leadership on this question, from the majority leader through the principals, there is a deep commitment to achieving a bipartisan effort.
So you don't believe this would have any long-term impact on your ability to get a deal with the Republicans?
I don't believe so. If the sincere effort to try and resolve these matters to the extent possible, I think this issue will take on less significance as we move along.
So the Drew and then Don.
Hi, Drew Armstrong, Congressional Reporter.
Yeah.
Senator Kennedy and Senator Baucus have talked about moving to separate but related bills on the floor and then combining them on the floor. Can you explain process-wise how that would work? I mean, are these going to be two puzzle pieces that fit together, or are we looking at two overlapping bills and this enforcing a messy place to do?
My sense of more the puzzle analogy makes sense rather than overlapping. And there's a lot of work going on to achieve that more the puzzle approach they fit rather than sitting there and trying to unravel pieces of legislation that have overlapped, and that's the strong desire. There's been a lot of cooperation. I want to commend Max Baucus on this point. I know he is going back, given Senator Kennedy's health issues. He has and this may not be well known. I know firsthand. He has made a real effort from early on, the beginning of this year, to spend a lot of time with Senator Kennedy personally, and talking about the issues and how they can work together. And then in the past, there had been sort of that tension, obviously, that always exists between committees with this overlapping jurisdiction. But Senator Baucus has been, it's not only because he's gracious and polite, but also because he recognizes how important that is.
So have they agreed to split up jurisdictional areas and say, you know, you handle this part of the public plan issue and you handle covering the uninsured so that it makes it for sort of, you know, if we're talking about the puzzle analogy, so it makes these together?
Mm-hmm.
Have they agreed on the jurisdictional split up?
Not that I know of, Tom. No, that's, I'm looking at staff over here to get confirmation of that, but that's not the case, not yet. Okay. Yeah.
Donna Smith with Reuters. I just want to go back to something you talked about a little bit earlier at your public forums. Judging
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise you if a lot of people sort of with the single payer constituency that show up a bit better organized and so forth. Oh, I think the recognition that probably is not going to be that's not going to be part of the plan that emerges here. But on the debate about a public plan, and just last Saturday was at a forum with Chris Murphy in the western part of Connecticut, not on health care, but just a general subject matter, but health care consumed a lot of the subject from the audience if you wanted to talk about it. And my there is a strong feeling that having a public option is desirable, and not necessarily to overwhelm private plans, but people like choice in this country. I was intrigued. It was I guess the administration had one of those town hall meetings in Vermont, and the crowd that showed up, I don't know if any of you were there or not, but the crowd that showed up were all very much in advocates of the single payer. And then someone asked the audience, how many of them have private insurance? All that wanted private insurance, all the hands went up in a way. So it's what people would like for the country, what they want for themselves, sometimes can differ. And we like the idea of having choices as Americans, and we want to be able to and have choices at various stages in our life, what our needs are in our 20s or 30s or 40s, and older is going to change, and be able to have the options of being able to sort of fit into a system that fits our needs is going to be terribly important. And having a public option, I think, is competitiveness. It's giving people's choice. It's giving people choices in that. And you can have, I mean, Medicare is a public-private option. It doesn't have to be that what a public option is. I think, first of all, I wish we could come up with a different language, because a lot of times the language over the years has created its own dynamic. You say certain things like Pavlov's dog, and people automatically sort of retreat to their respective political corners rather than thinking it through. What do you mean by that? And I think a public option can mean a lot more than just sort of a single-payer option, and that's going to be the responsibility, I think, of the leadership to help define those issues as we move forward. But I believe there's some common ground that can be achieved around that idea.
Yep. Robert.
Senator,
hey, Robert, how are you?
Good. You think that it's essential to include in any kind of big health care reform bill a way to pay for all of the new coverage and all of the cost, or 90% of it, 80, 70, are you thinking that there's some play in that?
Well, obviously what the president did with the $634 billion is sort of a down payment helps, obviously far short of what you're going to need. And I think, you know, laying out early on, we're going to have two very difficult jobs, it seems to me, aside from the specifics and the weeds on this. And that is to change the incentives of a healthcare system, where prevention is going to be very different than a system today that depends upon filling hospital beds and people showing up in doctor's offices. And that isn't just a difficult question for those of us shaping it, but as if Pitney Bowes, the experience is any indicator of where this is likely to go, and a company that's done a magnificent job of moving to prevention. They had difficulty with their employees moving to prevention, even though they had strong incentives to do so. That, and then convincing the American public that we're going to have to make investments in health care in order to reach that point where we can reduce that percentage of the gross domestic product that health care costs are consuming. And that's going to be a hard sell, because it isn't going to be 1 year or 2 years. It's going to take several years to do it. This is a long way to get around, Robert, to your question, but I think we're better off laying out these costs to people and letting the American public know what we're talking about and building that case for it to sustain the political support you'll need to have if this is truly going to achieve the results of providing the coverage for people as well as providing the quality that people are going to be insisting upon, and getting to the point where the costs are not, and I'm looking at the percentage of just the premium increase in the last 6 or 7 years, Connecticut's gone up 42% in 8 years, premium costs. I was looking at a number here, just a nationwide. In 1999, total family premium stood at $5,791, which workers paid about $1,500. 2008 was $12,600.
That's our number.
Yeah. I mean, just what's going up in just that amount of time, family cost. So I think that's laying out those costs, while there'll be those who may want to resist them, because I suspect they're not going to be insubstantial. I think clarity and honesty with people of what it's going to do for us, how it's going to get us there, is absolutely critical. Because we're talking about not just getting something through in July. If this is going to work, it's going to take a decade to really produce the kind of results you're going to need. And I think stepping up and saying to people, this is what it's going to be, we've got choices to make on this, but I want you to know, you know, where we're headed. And I'm a great believer if you do that, I think you have a greater possibility of sustaining that support and building on that support.
Julian Piquet, Inside Health Policy. Senator, you talked about the low-hanging fruit and maybe reaching the agreement on the public plan later, creating the support over a decade. So are we talking about maybe the bill that gets marked up in July isn't going to be the be-all, end-all, and some of the kinks will have to be worked out over time? How is that going to work out?
Well, because I think it's a fact. You know, there's a debate, obviously, whether or not you can have an individual mandate or an employer mandate, and there's a lot of discussion about all of that. We're looking, obviously, at what's happened, as Senator Bingham will do today, a hearing on these states. As a neighbor to Massachusetts, I've watched that very carefully. I've been fascinated about the reaction of the business community to the individual mandate. That it's been far more supportive than I imagined it might have been initially, although obviously cost issues are raising some questions. So I think it's important to tell people that some Monday we pass a health care bill, and there's a lot of cheering going on. The world doesn't change on Tuesday. It is going to take time for this all to work, and there'll be kinks in this to make it function as well as we'd like it to. It's a major, we're talking about a major and fundamental alteration of a major economic element in our country, the cost of health care, not to mention all of the dimensions that health care raises on another other set of levels. So I suspect that this will take some time for it to really to kick in all of its implications. And there will be some changes, clearly, as we examine what we've done and how it's working, as it should be.
So the financing part, will that be spelled out in the bill? This is how we're going to pay for it, or will that have to be other bills down the line?
Well, I think it will be spelled out, and there may be changes that occur along the way. You're going to, it's always that every Congress can go back and de novo begin a process over. So I suspect we'll try and lay out why, again, I think it's important that we get as close to a supermajorities on the bill as we can so you can sustain that kind of an effort. You end up with the narrowest of margins on this. You run the risk of another Congress another time being able to reverse those matters, and then you end up in the chaotic situation of not having clarity that people are looking for. And so I come back to the point earlier on the issue of reconciliation and whether or not Democrats are serious about trying to achieve that broad-based support. And again, if this were just to pass one bill, get it done, and boy, that's the end of that, we've now rewritten the law of the land forever, well, you might say, look, I'm tough, 51 votes, I'll take it, and we'll run with it. But if you're talking about sustaining something over a period of time that's going to require future Congresses, where the politics will clearly change, these numbers are going to fluctuate, obviously, in the makeup of the Congress, you want to have something that can sustain that kind of change, or you will end up with this thing being a chaotic mess, where one Congress took one set of actions and their successor went in a different direction. So there's a lot of reasons for trying to achieve those strong majorities. And why I feel so strongly about us trying to do it. Yeah.
Todd Leuenberg with Thompson. You're talking about sustained change in order to make this work, and how today a lot of the incentives are, you know, misdesigned, and it results in much higher costs. Where do you see the heavy lifting in terms of the sustained change, and where's the sustained effort going to have to go in terms of achieving the, you know, mathematical success of lowering costs and maybe even changing incentives, mindsets? Where do you see the heavy lifting?
Prevention is what I'd say. The prevention aspect, because it's a fundamental alteration of a system.
Well, I mean, if you put more money to prevention, how do you prevent costs of prevention going up, or a repeat of the same type of problems that we've had before?
Well, the idea is obviously with the prevention is you're keeping people away from a system, so they don't end up there, and that's the, and so it's incentivizing behaviors that reduce the likelihood you're going to end up with chronic illnesses, obesity. I mean, they're not a long list. That lifestyle changes can fundamentally alter the number of people that showing up. I mentioned premature births, just one example, 1 out of 8, and it's a staggering cost. Put aside the difficulty and the hardship that families live with, and in many cases forever with those children because of that. There are things that can be done. While we don't know fully all the answers on why premature births occur, we have some pretty good ideas in certain areas. Making a difference in those areas, if you're not impressed by the morality or ethics of the issue, you can reduce that $26 billion pretty significantly. Information technology, clearly. When you have the United States ranks along with the worst countries in the world on industrializations in infant mortality, as we do, clearly steps can be taken. I mean, that itself ought to be a source of collective embarrassment that this country of ours, with all of its opportunities and wealth, ranks along with the lowest of industrialized nations, or the poorest, rather, industrialized nations in infant mortality, steps that can be taken there. The point I'm meant to make to you is, because I was fascinated by this, is when we had the hearing with Pitney Bowes, and it just is a company where the CEO really made an effort on his own, and the company did a number of years ago, on moving to prevention. was surprised to hear him talk about how difficult it was to get employees, in effect. So the assumption that everyone's going to jump to prevention is a lifestyle change, I think, is a false assumption, that this is going to be hard. Your question is it going to be hard? I think that's going to be hard, but that piece of it is I think, going to be more difficult in some ways than many. We say the words prevention, and it sounds terrific. But how you get from point A to point B in this, I don't think is that simple, and it's going to be hard. And that's where a lot of the cost savings are going to come from. And getting from point A to point B is going to be a challenge, it seems to me. Yeah.
Yes, John Reichardt with the Congressional Quarterly's Health Beat. Just following up on Robert's question, were you suggesting in your answer that wider coverage would hinge on getting cost reductions first? You'd have to have cost reductions before you could proceed to expanding coverage?
Not necessarily, but obviously steps that can be taken to reduce those would be, I think, welcomed, and that would be helpful. But I'd be uneasy, as we've seen in the past, where cost savings come in Medicaid and Medicare, and you end up getting more of a problem for yourself in terms of longer-term issues. And so there clearly could be some things done there that would be help bring down initially some costs, but I'd get uneasy that's going to jump to that as a way of demonstrating that we're actually bringing down costs initially without the kind of investments that are necessary to ultimately bring down costs.
You said not necessarily. Does that mean that issue is still on the table, whether to go in the direction of requiring costs first as a condition of expanded coverage?
I don't know the answer. That's the question. I don't know if Max answered that question. Did you raise that with him?
With who?
With Baucus.
I have to.
Oh, okay. Let me get back to you on that one. I don't have an answer for you on that one. I mean, my sense is no. If you're asking me personally, I would say no. I think I wouldn't. That's not a condition precedent for me to move forward on it. But I mean, the question seemed to imply whether or not that was something that the broader group embraced, and I don't know the answer to that.
Get down this end.
No. Anna Edney with Congress Daily. Senator, do you support it to pay for some of this, possibly some kind of tax on health benefits? And have you been able to talk to Senator Kennedy about his thoughts on that?
Well, it comes up as part of probably doesn't come up with the same frequency that we've been discussing reconciliation of public plans, but obviously it's on the table. And I don't know. There's been no decision that I know of on that at all. And the president, of course, took a very firm position on that in the campaign. Of not wanting to change the tax issue, and that's going to be an important consideration, obviously, his viewpoint on it. So there's been no decision that I know of on that. I know it's part of the debate, but no decision has been made to change anything at this point.
Do you personally, would you support?
I'm reluctant. I mean, I think at this point, I'm willing to listen to some ideas in this. I wouldn't reject ideas in this area, but obviously, you know, to a large extent, that will have more appeal if you're able to deal with issues that can ultimately bring down cost to that extent. The tax exclusions are obviously an incentive to keep people in, and particularly with the pressures on smaller businesses and so forth, that can mean an awful lot. And at a time when you're trying to keep people at the table, having employer-based plans, which I support as being a part of this, I would not want to cause them to be discouraged from participation. So I'd be a little careful about changing that, unless you could tell me other pieces that are going to keep people in the mix.
My hometown newspaper, mm-hmm.
Susan Millett bought by the time they tell
Robert. We'll get to you quick, right, while you're still there.
While we're still publishing. Yeah. Susan Millett from the Boston Globe, or what's left of it. When you talk about the political environment in the next decade or whatever, and the difficulty of that, is that because of the pressure on the budget, or will people's, you know, lives change so much in the way that they get health care that they're going to have members are going to have a difficult time sustaining support among their constituents?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think there's obviously the budget pressures are going to be huge. These matters are all interrelated. I mean, Ron mentioned in his introduction dealing with the banking committee issues and when they're dealing with energy issues. They're not stovepipes sitting around and where what happens in each one of them sort of has no bearing on the other. I mean, they all do in a sense. I mean, I think the president's been criticized by some because he's biting off an awful lot here, but in a sense he's biting off pieces that are all integrated with the question of whether or not you get the economy back on its feet. And you cannot have a serious conversation about economic recovery and exclude health care. It's a non-starter. I don't know how you have debate or discussion if you exclude that. So this is a critical component. I mean, we're all talking about foreclosure mitigation and credit flowing and all these other issues, which are very important. But if you've got to deal with this question, and the reason that table got filled, and with people who are willing to sit and work at this, was because people are coming with different perspectives, not the least of which is the economic one, and that's increased the size of the table, and I think the likelihood that you can get a result. That was what was missing in many ways 15 years ago from that table, and that the fact they weren't at that table made it, I think, almost from the beginning, if you look back on it in hindsight, very difficult to assume that was going to work. Even if you change how the process worked, you know, whether or not the Congress was more involved with the White House in 93 and 94, that it might have had a better climate, I think the absence of the seats at the table from the economic interests made that very difficult anyway. This is different, in my view. And so that's got a major factor. I also believe, Susan, that once this gets moving, and if, in fact, we can do this, as we hope it will, that sense of loss, that one out of three Americans that I mentioned between 2000 and 2008 that were at one point or another in that year period without health care coverage, and that gripping fear that something happens to you in that window, or to a member of your family, and all of a sudden your life has just been fundamentally altered forever, is going to sustain, I think, the effort to move forward. I think once this happens, much as it was with these other debates that have occurred earlier, when it was on Medicare or Medicaid going back, all of the concerns raised about it, you don't hear anybody today unraveling that. And those were bitter debates back, long before I got here, but nonetheless watching, listening to the discussions. Listen to Bob Dole talk about it years ago, where he opposed Medicare as a new member, relatively new member of Congress in those days. So I think if we can get this going, and it's producing the kind of security that people are seeking, that it's going to be awfully difficult to roll that back. Yeah.
Matt Tobias with Modern Healthcare. Yeah. Senator, you mentioned that you want to see children's health as part of broader healthcare reform. Can you say a little bit more about that? What kind of initiatives would you like to see? What are you specifically targeting? And also, where does that fall under the jurisdiction of the committee as well?
Well, both falls back and forth, obviously, because things like child care, the Finance Committee has a lot to say about some of that as well. And they've been great. People like Olympia Snow have been terrific on the issues. She's been a great partner as we've tried over the years to get some additional support in the Child Care Development Block Grant. So it's one that, even though it was a real battle back some 20-odd years ago, and the first child care program since World War II, and we went through a tough period in the last 8 years because it was pretty much... We didn't have very little growth in the program. That I think it still is an idea that people are very supportive of. On the issue of even with the CHIP program and Medicaid, we're still an awful lot. There's a substantial number of kids that still are not covered. I mentioned 21 million are covered of the in those programs, and you have 9 million of the 45 million who, without any, that's pretty staggering. That the most innocent, if you will, whether innocence has a legitimate description of people here, but nonetheless are excluded from any kind of coverage is a pretty significant gap. So making sure we close that gap. As I mentioned earlier, whether it's medical devices, pharmaceutical drugs, and so forth, understanding that children are not just small versions of adults. And so being conscious of that as you look at the FDA, in terms of how we proceed, I think is important. And I like, you know, it isn't just with children. I think this has got to begin with maternal care in a way, that an awful lot could be done. I mentioned the premature birth issue. If you can really begin early on this matter and insist that be a part of the debate, you can make a big difference, both financially as well as the lives of people. And so those are some aspects that I'd want to see a part of the debate. We had a And Kathleen Sebelius, by the way, and I hope we can move on this quickly. I mean, if there's this issue of the swine flu and so forth, make it clear that we ought to get a Secretary of Health and Human Services on board. But in her confirmation hearing, talking about the maternal care and the value of it and how much cost savings can be achieved, if that's all that motivates you, that significant cost savings can be made. When we wrote the infant screening legislation a few years ago, huge cost savings. There aren't many cases, thank God, that emerge, but when they do, they're staggering in their cost. And by having more the infant screening tests that go on now up to 32 from the 8 that you could take advantage of, been able to save lives and significant cost savings. So there are aspects of that that we want to
Yeah. Hey, Palmer, ADA News. Yeah. Since you raised swine flu, is the committee considering any hearings on that matter? And more importantly, by your earlier scenario, the increasing numbers of people who are having catastrophic problems, fueling the need for reform of some kind, could swine flu play into that?
Well, we've done. As a part of the debates, I forget how many years ago it was on BARDA, where were the pandemic issues that we raised, and Congress isn't always ahead of itself. But I must say, for those who are urging this, I think after 9/11, those issues began to emerge and people began to think about it. The kind of manufactured attack, rather than one necessarily come about in this case. So we're in actually much better shape to respond to this situation than we would have been even a few years ago. Not that there are trying to find many blessings out of 9/11, but the fact that there was action taken on these issues was a positive event. And Tom Harkin is having a hearing today under his auspices as the chairman of the Subcommittee on Appropriations. Senator Kennedy has scheduled a hearing for Wednesday, tomorrow afternoon, on the HELP Committee. And I think there are others as well. I don't think there are, so there are going to be some hearings on this, obviously. I'm told this morning there have been about 40 cases in the United States, 150 deaths in Mexico. I gather the restrictions on travel have been lifted. Or are they? Is that what I heard?
The U.S. is issuing travel advisories for U.S. citizens traveling to Mexico.
Mexico. That's still in place? Okay. But the one in Europe about...
The EU one
has been changed, backed off. That's what I heard. Okay. And I'm told we have the dosages are adequate and available, and there's some efforts because there's a strain of this that is raising some issues, but I gather there's a lot of work being done as we speak to make sure that kind of the kind of protections will be there. Is that correct, Amar? Yeah. Anything else on that point? No? Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Elisa Marcus with Bloomberg News. I'm just wondering how flexible Democrats are willing to be in the end when it comes to this issue of the public plan, given all the... The sort of pressures on the Republicans on reconciliation. I mean, if they come to you finally and say, okay, we're willing to support this, but we don't want a public plan, is there going to be flexibility in the Democratic Party, do you think?
Well, there's flexibility. I don't, and again, I'm speaking for your, hesitant to always speak for my colleagues under any set of circumstances, but I think competitiveness is going to be important. If it's a plan that just makes it impossible for private plans to function, then I think we've done a disservice. I mean, I don't feel that way at all. I want to see us, to the extent there's a public plan, that it creates an opportunity for people that wouldn't otherwise fit into a private plan someplace. I don't want to end up excluding people in a way because they don't fit into the narrower plans that may be out there. So, I think it's the language. I think if we take a breath here, and people relax and step back, and let's have a conversation about what we really mean by this. I think the temperature can get lowered. The danger here is that they're all of a sudden attributing certain conclusions to certain language, and I don't feel hard over at all on a public plan as the other side envisions it, but excludes private participation, or even as part of a public plan having some private features to all of this. So I'm very open, sort of agnostic on the question of how that could work. And I suspect most of my colleagues are. So I wouldn't want to jump to your conclusion yet at this point that people are going to sort of back away from a public plan. I don't sense that. And the question is whether or not reasonable people can sit down and craft something that will hopefully satisfy enough of a strong majority. Yes.
Mark Sheff of Cranes Workforce Management. I have a question about paid sick days and paid FMLA. Could those ideas move along with health care reform and be seen as part of access, or do those kinds of bills have to wait until after this health care reform debate is done?
Well, as the author of the Family Medical Leave, I'll I've got a bill in on, I don't know, have we introduced it again? Or are we about to, I guess? May have introduced. We didn't last Congress. We'll do it again, but I suspect that one will probably have to wait. I think it's a very creative and imaginative plan, but I suspect, given the hostility just to family medical leave, let alone paid leave, that it probably would probably have to wait for a further debate. That if I threw that into the mix on this thing, I can imagine the kind of reaction it might get. So, Let me make a case for it, though. I'll tell you, not without the specifics of it, but 80% of the people who don't take family medical leave don't take it because of cost. They can't afford to do it. And in a lot of cases, these are moderate-income working families that just can't take. They might get a few days, but the idea of taking 6 weeks or 7 weeks of the 12 weeks, it's just out of the question for them. Their economics, their family economics, just don't allow it, and despite the fact they may have a very legitimate need for that kind of time. And we fashioned a plan here that would involve employee participation as well as employer participation and some public on sliding scales in a way so it isn't, you know, one size fits all, as a way of making it possible for people to do this. And the value of it, aside from 60 million people now since 1993 have used family and medical leave. And everywhere I go, almost on a daily basis, someone stops me to tell me how valuable it's been to them, whether it was for a week or two or whatever. And that ability to be there with a child recovering or a family member, every doctor I know of will tell you that the rate of recovery of someone that has family or loved one around just is significantly higher and quicker. And so there's a value beyond just people's fear of losing a job or the emotional attachment. There actually is a cost benefit to this. But I would not at this juncture want to necessarily throw that into this mix.
Okay. We're going to do a couple more, and then see if the senator wants to do a final benediction.
Well, I think you've hit it pretty much. I mean, though, and it seems more sort of what I call sort of bumper sticker reactions to this. This is going to be socialized medicine, that it's a takeover, that I won't have choices, I won't be able to choose my doctor, I won't be able to choose my plan, it's just someone else, Washington's going to be deciding. It's almost like some old ads, in a way, and I just don't think they're resonating terribly well, except within that similar constituency, which is shrinking, it seems to me. Again, the fact that people like the National Association, the Small Business NFIB, and others are involved and really engaged in this. When you had Andy Stern and Jeff from Pfizer, what's Jeff Kendler, forming that kind of coalition, talking about issues. Who, imagine 13 years ago, the head of a labor union, the head of a pharmaceutical company, sitting down and working on plans together going forward. It would have been unheard of. So that's what I hear. But I don't think it has much currency with the general population. That's why I mentioned earlier, I say respectfully to my colleagues, deciding to kill health care over reconciliation. I just can't imagine anyone who's sitting around saying, you better come up with a better argument than that, or you're going to be in a very tough position. This is an issue now that really reaches. This isn't just a question of poorer people or children or some narrow group out there. This is one that is widely felt. From a lot of different perspectives, and I think to derail this at this critical moment would be a huge mistake. Let me gratuitously offer a comment as well, since you haven't asked the question, but I want the White House involved, and they need to be at the table. This is a question where people going back and there's sort of a people's memories of 15 years ago get exaggerated to some degree, and it's not quite as bad as people remember it about the White House and excluding the Congress. But nonetheless, I think it's very important that as we move forward over these next very critical few weeks, that this is the White House is not sitting around waiting to see what we do and then deciding whether or not they like it or not. I think they've got to be there with us. You know.
Is the president on board with that idea too? Because this has been a very deliberate strategy on their part.
Well, I don't know if they are, and that's why I raised it here this morning, Karen. I was waiting for someone to raise it, so I was fearful it wasn't going to be. I might bring it up on my own.
One more question. Who wants the last question?
Yeah, let's go back.
Yeah, Jeff.
How are you? Without giving short shrift to the many, many issues that are involved in this, which is the 20th of August, Nate's is one of us briefing again on Friday, I still would like to know, I mean, does it concern you that about 6 weeks away from the markups, according to the schedule the chairman has laid out, that even among Democrats and between Democrats in the Senate and the White House, there still don't seem to be any decisions or even strongly held feelings about which way to go on the public plan, on financing, on what have always been the most difficult issues to solve?
Well, it's classic Washington, and there's nothing like moving forward that gets people to make decisions. As long as you don't have to, no one wants to. And so by what Max is doing, and I think wisely, and Senator Kennedy is saying, we're now, we've had a lot of conversations, a lot of meetings, a lot of sitting around tables and raising very legitimate issues, and now we're going to sit down and start writing. And so people have to start making decisions or seeking compromises in a way that allow you to go forward. That just doesn't happen until you force it. I always say you have to schedule a markup to get people to come to the table to really sit down and figure something out together. And so this is always going to be a subject matter that obviously there's strong feelings about and where the direction we head in. But I think that's not going to change until you actually have a moment in which you're going to force people to be at that table to make decisions. And so you could schedule a markup next November, and I don't think you'd end up with any better decision making between now and then if you waited that long. I think you'd still be sitting around table debating the pros and cons of various ideas. When you actually schedule that we're going to start writing and working at this thing, that you end up people coming and getting serious about making decisions. And so in the absence of having this schedule, I think it would be difficult to get those kinds of answers, so I applaud it.
Senator, you made a number of really strong final comments just in the last 5 minutes, but would you like to make another one?
I probably better not.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. You know, last time was all public plan all the time, and this was incredibly far-reaching and dealt with a number of issues. So thank you, thank you all for being with us. Remember, May 7th is Senator Hatch, so we'll see you then.
Well, that ought to be interesting.
Well, you're welcome to come. Maybe I'll show up just to freak him out a little bit.